I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Why do great strategies fail? That's the question Michael Rayner asks in his new book, The Strategy Paradox. He says the job of leaders is to embrace the inherent uncertainty of strategy and recognize that the future can't be predicted. Instead of making choices, leaders create options. Michael Rayner is our guest today on Smart City. Our second topic today is a strategy critical to cities, how to leverage universities and other anchor institutions to contribute fully to urban success and in turn to their own. Dr. David Morass of MARGA is with us to talk about the challenges and rewards of these partnerships. That's today on Smart City, right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. A compelling vision, bold leadership, decisive action. Unfortunately, these prerequisites of success are almost always the ingredients of failure, too. So says Michael Rayner, author of The Strategy Paradox, Why Committing to Success Leads to Failure and What to Do About It. Michael is a distinguished fellow with Deloitte Research in Boston and co-author with Clayton Christensen of the best-selling The Innovator's Solution. Michael, you use the story of Sony Betamax and Minidisc to illustrate the strategy paradox. You write that these strategies didn't fail because they were bad strategies. They failed because they were great strategies. Explain what you mean.
Sure. Well, nobody ever said that great strategy was a guarantee of success. So that's really not the nature of my concern here. The nature of my concern was that, and I chose Sony as sort of an archetype of this phenomenon, is that it seemed to me that in the case of Betamax, I also spent some time talking about their mini-disc problems, but in the case of Betamax in particular, their failure was complete precisely because their strategy so sharply manifested all of the characteristics of great strategy. So what I mean by that is the following. Strategies that hold the promise of the greatest success are typically strategies that are premised on a bold vision of the future and a material commitment to making that vision a reality. And this is consistent with what you see in any number of books purporting to describe how you can be a successful organization. Right? You have to have some bold, compelling vision of the future. You have to never take no for an answer. You have to be relentless in your pursuit of that, and that's what it takes to be great. And I think that's actually true, but the problem is that that's an incomplete description of what comes along for the ride, because when you make those kinds of commitments, when you refuse to take no for an answer, yes, you're increasing the probability of actually achieving something remarkable, but you're also increasing the probability of a total failure. So, for example, if Sony had taken a much more one step at a time, toe-in-the-water approach to commercializing VCR technology, they may well not have been completely pushed from the market by the more successful VHS standard, which was offered up by Matsushita, but they would have foregone any possibility of ultimately dominating the market as they hoped to. They made very rigorous and largely irreversible commitments to a particular consumer application and to a particular strategy, right? They optimized their device for time-shifting television programs, and they invested in creating the very best technology they could. And that's precisely what they needed to do if they wanted to dominate the market. But as it turned out, for reasons that no one could have predicted, that wasn't the right application to focus on. It should have been renting movies and showing them at home, and it wasn't the right strategy. People didn't want high-fidelity recording. What they wanted was a cheap machine that allowed them to watch movies. And so they made perfectly reasonable but ultimately incorrect bets. And since they were such big bets and so hard to reverse, well, their failure was essentially complete.
Well, as you point out, Sony wasn't able to predict the future accurately, and you make the point that no one can predict the future accurately. So how do we prepare for it?
Sure, I think that's the right question. I mean, if it seems like greatness requires commitment, but commitment collides with uncertainty, what are we supposed to do? Some folks will suggest that the right response is to essentially adapt to the future, right? That the trick is to create an agile, responsive organization. And I think that's actually great advice. If you can do it, more power to you. The problem is that, again, being an adaptive organization essentially requires you to sacrifice the benefits of commitment. So if you're highly adaptive, you'll always finish fourth to the three other companies that managed to bet right. Yeah, you'll do better than all the companies that bet wrong, but you'll never be great. And so the cost of adaptability, it seems to me, is the opportunity to achieve outsized success. And so as a consequence, what I advocate is what I call strategic flexibility. That's a term that people may have bumped into in other guises, but I intend it really to be a bit of an oxymoron. Right? Strategy, as I've suggested, is all about commitment, and flexibility is about, well, avoiding commitment. So we're trying to put those two things together. And the way I try to think about making that a reality is for organizations to create what I'll call a series of strategic options, the ability to actually put in place businesses or particular initiatives that allow them to develop the kinds of resources or capabilities that they might need at some point in the future, recombining those assets as required in order to then respond to uncertainties as they are resolved.
Now, square that with this notion of great strategy requiring great commitment. I mean, isn't that, in fact, a hedge from great commitment?
Well, yes and no. I mean, at some level, what I'm trying to do is really, in most organizations, separate who makes commitments from who manages uncertainty. So I'll give you a concrete example, one that I explore at some length in my book, which is Microsoft. So Microsoft is an organization that, in my view, has, for much of its history, effectively managed a portfolio of strategic options. So if you go back to 1988, to pick a date, you've got an organization that had a portfolio of a number of different initiatives. They were pushing MS-DOS, right? That was sort of their bread and butter. Their bread and butter product. They were developing OS2, which was a graphical user interface in collaboration with IBM. They had their own graphical operating system, which was Microsoft Windows. By 88, it was version 2.0. They were dabbling in Unix, and in fact, they spent a great deal of time and effort writing applications for the Apple operating system, right, which is a competing and completely incompatible OS. So I look at that as a portfolio of strategic options, and I mean that by that something very specific. A lot of folks will look at a diversified portfolio like that and conclude, well, really they're just going in a bunch of directions at once, right? They've walked up to the roulette table and they're betting red and black. I don't think that's what's happening there, because as anybody who's ever been to Vegas will be able to tell you, betting red and black on the roulette table is a guaranteed losing strategy, right? You can't cover all your bets. The way I think about what was going on there is that Microsoft had a very clear sense of precisely where they wanted to compete, right? That this was not a mutual fund, right? There was no Korean shipbuilding in the portfolio, just in case the whole information economy thing didn't work out. Yeah. So they were very careful of, in terms of where they were placing their investments. And furthermore, they were making investments that were potentially complementary to each other, right? Diversification, when it's in defense of ignorance, is the kind of thing where you buy sunglasses and umbrellas, so no matter what the weather, you've got a winner, right? That's not what was going on here. There were a series of investments that the critical uncertainties in the software industry, in my view, were things like what were going to be the critical markets, commercial markets or consumer markets? What was going to be the critical technology? Was it going to be menu-driven operating systems that were parsimonious with computing power, or would it be graphical operating systems that were somewhat profligate with processing power? Was it all about applications, or, and this was the big question mark, what about the nature of the interdependence between the operating system and the applications? Microsoft, I think, was unique among computer companies at the time in essentially covering each of these as individual initiatives. So let me come back to your specific question. At any point in time, the folks who were running each of those individual initiatives, I hesitate to call them divisions because I don't think they were actual organizational divisions within Microsoft. So the folks running each of these initiatives, in fact, were making commitments to being as successful as they could within the industry as it was at that time, right? So they were making precisely the kinds of strategic commitments required for greatness. But at the level of the portfolio, what you ended up with was, in fact, something that had structurally lower strategic risk. Why? Well, because a critical uncertainty, for instance, is what about the integration of operating systems and applications? Well, they had a Microsoft Windows division that was dedicated to being successful, and they did it. They had an applications division that was dedicated to being successful, and they did it. And as a consequence of that, they were able to integrate those two things in a way that created yet a higher level of performance. And so as a result, I think I have made some step toward, I hope, squaring that circle, right? That by describing what was going on inside Microsoft, we have some window into how a firm can both commit to specific strategies while at the same time creating strategic options, having, if you will, strategic flexibility.
You make a point about the critical questions of uncertainty. How do you identify those questions, Michael, since they are indeed so critical?
Yeah, no, it's, again, a very good point. Once you back off the assumption that you can predict the future with any certainty, it's tempting to sort of be paralyzed by the overwhelming nature of an unpredictable future. You know, you sort of, oh my goodness, I can't put a pin in the map, so now you just want to put your head under the pillow. So you need a useful intermediate state, and scenario-based planning, I think, is a pretty good place to start. Scenario-based planning is something that gets a bit of a bad rap in a lot of circles. I mean, in my experience, people have either never done scenario-based planning and they think it sounds pretty neat, or they have done scenario-based planning and they've concluded it's a waste of time. And part of the reason I think that's true is because it's been largely disconnected from decisions made in the here and now. Right? So scenario building is a very good way, I think, to begin describing what the future might be. Right, so you're neither predicting what it will be nor simply throwing your hands up in the air and saying, I have no idea. Mm-hmm. Right? So you're thinking very carefully about various drivers of change, about how they might interact over time, and really trying to create what we refer to as the possibility space. Right? Because not anything can happen. Right? There are some boundaries of, with respect to the possible, and even within the boundaries of the possible, it makes sense to think carefully about what is in fact plausible. So the scenario-based planning toolkit, I think, is enormously useful for that. Where I think, as I suggested a moment ago, the wheels have tended to come off the bus is because it seems, and at least as I've observed it, it tends to degenerate into a bit of an intellectual exercise exclusively. You know, people are thinking about 10 years from now, and they tend to describe the decisions that they might make 10 years from now. But it's hard to maintain much energy around the things that you're going to do later. So what we've tried to do is connect those scenarios, in fact, to the decisions you might take today.
And who do you think is doing good scenario-based planning?
Well, certainly Johnson & Johnson, the life sciences company, I think does a very good job of this. And they use scenarios actually in some very innovative ways, thinking not only about sort of what are the sorts of things that they are going to do, but in fact thinking carefully about what sorts of things their competitors are going to do and how those two things might interact under future industry structures. So I think they've been very creative and really very rigorous and persistent in doing this, because one of the keys to scenario-based planning is to understand that it needs to be a continuous process. If you create a set of scenarios that describe the world 10 years from now and you don't revisit them, you're not taking advantage of new information. Right? Today, our view of 2017 is probably going to be very different than what our view of 2017 will be 5 years from now. Right? Mm-hmm. We're constantly updating. And so taking that seriously is enormously important, and J&J is certainly one company that I think has done that quite well.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Michael Rayner. He's the author of the new book, The Strategy Paradox, Why Committing to Success Leads to Failure and What to Do About It. I want to ask you about a couple of footnotes, oddly enough. As I told you, I love the footnotes in your book. I love the way you handled them, and they're actually quite interesting and sort of spin out some interesting bits of business information. There's one footnote in which you challenge the idea of core competence. Describe, Michael, the concept of core competence and why you think it may be wrong.
Well, core competence, at least as I think it has become to be practiced in a lot of companies, it tends to take the form of sort of sticking to your knitting, finding one small set of capabilities, and focusing relentlessly on them. Which, interestingly enough, is not, in my view, how the term was actually intended to be used by Gary Hamel and C.K. Prahalad, the two business school professors that originally coined the term, I think in a 1990 HBR article. When they first talked about it, they were actually seeing core competence as a platform for diversification into new markets. But as people have come to use it, it's tended to mean this sort of ever narrower focus on one small set of capabilities. And I think that's actually a very limiting way of thinking about organizational success for at least two reasons. First of all, it leaves out, at least explicitly, maybe implicit, but most of the time it leaves out the notion that it's all well and good to focus very carefully on one set of capabilities and get really good at it, but that's not particularly useful if nobody finds it especially valuable. Right? If you're really good at something nobody wants, that's not a recipe for success. That's something I discovered the hard way when I took a degree in philosophy. The other piece of the puzzle, it seems to me, is that core competence in the face of a changing and uncertain future really tends to lock you in, right? So even if you're really good at something that people value highly today, no guarantee that will persist. And so focusing on a core competence seems to me to essentially create, and there have been a number of investigations in this direction, creates a core rigidity when the future changes and you mm-hmm. can't, right? Because what starts out being focused turns out to be kind of wrapped around the axle.
Mm-hmm. There's another footnote, I think. Well, actually, I think you cover this in a chapter. You do a quick review of the literature on generic strategies, and you come up with two ends of the spectrum, cost and efficiency hold down one end, and an outward focus, which I thought actually was nice. It was a nice way to wrap in several concepts. Porter called it differentiation, would be on the other end. Now, trying to operate in the middle with a hybrid strategy leaves a company vulnerable on both flanks. You're a big thinker strategy guy. Is the same thing true for cities?
That's an interesting question. The two business school professors, Stu Thornhill and Rod White, that I collaborated with on the work that I think you're referring to is in Chapter 3, which attempts to really test the limits of that hypothesis, right? That the money lies at the extremes, right? You mm-hmm. want to have either a cost leadership or a product differentiation strategy. Being stuck in the middle is a recipe for mediocrity. And we've actually started to look into the possibility of looking at cluster theory in the context of economic development to try and understand precisely the same thing. I've actually done some work with the Economic Developers Council of Ontario. I live in Mississauga, Ontario, Canada. And a lot of the economic development folks are concerned about, clearly, the economic viability of their regions, if not their cities. And so as a consequence, they spend a lot of time in trying to ensure that they have a diversified base of employers, right? Because they mm-hmm. figure that diversification will smooth out any of the bumps in the general economic cycle and that the regions will enjoy general economic prosperity as a result. Perfectly reasonable proposition, seems to me. What I'm wondering, and so unfortunately I don't have a direct answer to your question, but I think we have some way to begin to cozy up to an answer, is that does it make sense for regions, for geographic regions, municipalities, so forth, to try and cover so many bets, to have heavy manufacturing and financial services and healthcare and in the interest of diversification? Or does that manifest, and tell me if this is where you're going, or does that manifest a stuck-in-the-middle strategy to economic development? I think it might. I think the analog might be more than just a metaphor. The relationship to the strategy continuum might be, okay, so as an economic region, what I should do then is focus on some particular sector of activity, right? So I'm going to focus on, as I said before, one of any of the other sectors I just mentioned, financial services or manufacturing or education, you name it. And what I'm wondering is if there is a way to create similarly a set of strategic options at the level of economic development, right? So that rather than focusing either on one particular industry or focusing on sort of a shotgun approach to getting a little bit of everything, it may be in fact possible to think about the scenarios of the future and then begin to develop those sectors of the economy that in fact are potentially complementary to each other. And that, in fact, are likely to prosper under the circumstances that, in fact, your scenario-based planning exercise suggests you might materialize.
Yeah, spin that out a little bit, Michael, in terms of what that might look like for a city.
Well, I think moving past what I would claim to be my expertise. So forgive me if this is a bit hand-wavy, but I think it manifests itself in a willingness to think a little more carefully about the different sectors within a broader industry, right? So if you were to think about, for example, healthcare. Within healthcare, you have everything from pharmaceuticals to medical devices to hospitals of various types, teaching hospitals, university hospitals, that sort of thing. And the view is that it that clusters, right? That clusters that cover the general spectrum of activity will in fact both enjoy greater performance and lower risk than something that focuses exclusively on hospitals or attempts to get hospitals and heavy manufacturing and financial services, right? Mm-hmm. So that it makes the most sense to cover the value chain rather than to focus on one particular industry or to spread your investments too widely.
Michael Rayner, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from PlanEdison assistant editor Nate Berg.
Whether you noticed it or not, last Sunday was Earth Day. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg celebrated the often disregarded occasion by announcing a plan for the next quarter century that includes more than 100 efforts to handle the city's future and growth in environmentally friendly ways. The New York Times reports that the plan includes many efforts to reduce the city's energy consumption, plant more than 1 million trees, and make citywide improvements to public transportation. His most controversial proposal is the creation of a congestion pricing system that would charge drivers to enter Manhattan during peak hours. Similar traffic regulations have been implemented in London and Stockholm, and while they have been the subject of many complaints and much controversy, transportation experts have found them to be successful in reducing congestion and air pollution. The mayor's plan will now head to the governor, who will make the final decision to approve many of the proposals, and the overall price tag, which is in the billions. And while New York's may be one of the country's most progressive plans to address global warming, a county in California is being sued because its plan doesn't even consider the impending effects of climate change. The state attorney general has joined environmental groups in a lawsuit against the Southern California county of San Bernardino because its long-term growth plan does not include any studies into how the county can reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. The San Bernardino Sun reports that county officials have gone on the defense, saying their plan was already in late stages of development when the state passed its law requiring the consideration of global warming last September. But the attorney general is not backing down, saying that because San Bernardino County is one of the fastest-growing counties in the state, its growth could have a significant impact on the climate. And finally, the Russian government has revealed plans to build the world's longest tunnel. And not just the world's longest tunnel, but an intercontinental tunnel. This proposed tunnel would link Siberia to the tip of Alaska by creating a 64-mile-long underwater tunnel, twice as long as the channel between England and France. Bloomberg reports that the tunnel would include pipelines for oil, natural gas, and electricity, as well as a highway and a high-speed railway. Russian and Asian governments are hoping this intercontinental link will help provide resources to remote locations in Siberia and Asia, and that the tunnel will serve as a new east-west transport corridor. If approved, the project tunnel would be complete within 10 to 15 years. For PlanEdison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for PlanEdison. After a short break, we'll be back to talk with David Morass of MARGA on the challenges and rewards of building partnerships among a city's anchor institutions. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. David Morass is the president, CEO, and founder of MARGA Incorporated, a global consulting firm dedicated to forging and strengthening pathways to take on the great issues of the 21st century. He's on the faculty at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs, and his latest book is In Listening to Harlem, Gentrification, Community, and Business. David, partnerships make up a significant component of your work at MARGA. Much of your work has been with universities. What is the role of a university in a community beyond its education mission?
Universities have a number of potential roles that they can play in communities in terms of sharing the resources that they bring to the table in terms of their knowledge and their research capacity. I think there are many resources in terms of human capacity, in terms of students, in terms of faculty, being able to engage students in real-world experiential learning projects that simultaneously benefit their learning as well as surrounding communities. And I also think universities are able to provide a great deal of economic development to surrounding communities as well. And again, this is a way in which universities benefit as well as their surrounding communities. What's interesting about higher education is that, not like any other institution, higher education really depends on its environment. When people attend an institution of higher education as a student, they think of the entire experience of being there. It's very much beyond what goes on exactly on the campus. It very much is also about the surrounding area. And that's the same for faculty and staff positions as well. People are thinking about what kind of experience they're going to have in that particular community. So it's very much in the interest of universities to be very much in partnership with their surrounding communities.
When you talk about the economic development potential or role of a university, to what are you referring?
Universities can provide employment. They can also provide purchasing. Many of the people who attend universities and who are employed by universities also actually spend a great deal of money in their surrounding communities. Universities are also involved in real estate development, and all of these are areas where universities have a vested interest in making sure that their economic flows are very much in sync with the surrounding community.
What are the best examples you've seen of community university partnerships at work?
Well, many people often refer to the University of Pennsylvania as an example of an institution that has spent a great deal of its own resources in community and economic development. And I think part of what's interesting about that particular story, as well as the stories of other institutions like the University of Southern California or Duke University or Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, many of these institutions have found that ultimately it is in their vested interest to be involved in their surrounding communities. And I think when we look at universities that have done an effective job in economic development, usually they're the ones that have been able to gain some kind of commitment in their leadership and in their strategic vision overall as an institution. When you think about all of the major aspects of a university, they can all be in some way, shape, or form enhanced by involvement in the local community. So the University of Pennsylvania, for example, is very much an institution that has gained a great deal of value as for the core of its institution in terms of furthering its mission by improving its surrounding community. It has made it a more livable community for the surrounding area, but then it has simultaneously employed people from the surrounding community. It has purchased from businesses that employ in the surrounding community that are owned by people who are in the surrounding community. So in very many ways, they have created a mutually beneficial arrangement.
And I know you've worked directly with a number of these universities. You mentioned Duke, you mentioned Trinity, University of Southern Cal, and of course the great story at Penn. Can you give me a better idea of what these civic or community university partnerships look like? What form did they take? What happened? How did they involve themselves in the community? How did they invest in the community? And what were the returns to the university?
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of what we get into in our work at Marga Incorporated is helping to advise universities on some kind of a process by which they can work with the surrounding community to make a change. So the efforts that they're involved in are not only about serving the university's interests, they're also about serving the community's interests, and they're also about participation across the board. So if universities are going to be effective, sometimes they create offices for community partnerships, which are often separate from offices that focus on community and government relations, which sometimes take more of a public relations spin to community partnerships. I think community partnerships can be distinguished in that they really are about benefit across the board, and they're also in many ways about engagement, that you have participation of community organizations, of local government, of local businesses, along with the participation of universities. And in many of these partnerships, you will often find a number of different projects that, as I had mentioned, really span the gamut in terms of what universities can provide. So sometimes you'll find a situation where a community partnership will require research. So, for example, I am working right now with Columbia University's Earth Institute as they create what they call an urban design lab. And in the urban design lab, the intent is to match the resources, the expertise of faculty with community-based organizations that are working on sustainability concerns. So the community-based organizations, such as Sustainable South Bronx as an example, are really looking for university research to help them make a case for whatever issues they're interested in. So, for example, if they're interested in the health of the neighborhood and how it's being in some way, shape, or form negatively affected by air quality, what kind of research can actually contribute to their understanding of what's going on in their community, and how can that research and that data help assist these community organizations in actually, in some way, shape, or form, making a case to policymakers? And you will also find examples as far as learning is concerned, where you have many courses that actually help different entities conduct their work. So we actually are working on a partnership where my class is actually providing assistance with research to really look at the variety of different ways in which various major institutions can be involved in their cities. And so in many ways, for the students, there's an opportunity in terms of being involved in a project that is applied and has real-world implications. This is a project that can help inform leaders in cities around the country around potential ways in which their museums, their hospitals, and their parks can be leveraged in ways that benefit their cities. And for the students, this is a great experience. This is incredible learning. It's also, in many ways, an opportunity for them to be able to apply what they're learning in the class to a real-world situation.
What have you learned, David, about what makes these community partnerships work?
I think you need the commitment of leadership around the board. You need buy-in from multiple stakeholders. You need a clear vision in some way, shape, or form of the various partners who are at the table. And it's very important for all stakeholders who are involved in community partnerships, whether they're universities or other types of institutions, to be able to see what they can gain from being at the table in these partnerships and understanding that partnerships actually contribute to some core aim, some core business value or mission of the institution at the table. And I think the partnerships that are most effective to me are ones that are actually able to demonstrate results. And over time, if partnerships begin to meet and people continue to come to the table, over time they'll want to see specific gains and specific results. And if those results aren't surfacing at some point in time, it's hard for people to continue to stay invested.
And what makes partnerships tank? They're hard work.
I think that is it. Hard work. Partnerships, for a lot of reasons, take additional time. And if there's no clarity about why people are, the individual partners are at the table in partnerships, are actually gaining from being involved, it's going to be very difficult for them to justify continued involvement. I also think resources end up becoming major barriers because institutions always have resources allocated and committed in various ways and not necessarily allocated particularly toward external partnerships. And so what often happens is that people are in some way, shape, or form borrowing from other line items in order to spend time participating in meetings. So for the first meeting and the second meeting and the third meeting, it may be okay, it may be exciting, it may be exhilarating, but by the fourth and fifth and sixth meetings, all of a sudden people begin to wonder, where is the value? And they're going to really want to justify why it's important for them to be at the table. And that's why the approach that we take in our work in advising and strengthening partnerships at Marga Incorporated is very much focused on mutual benefit and very much focused on assessing where the different partners can gain by being involved up front and being clear about that. Communication issues are also challenging barriers that partnerships face, in the sense that when we're talking about cross-sector partnerships, we really are discussing different patterns of decision-making, different cultures, different worldviews, coming to the table, working to find some common agenda. That doesn't happen overnight, and that is not automatic in any way, shape, or form. And so that's why we spend a lot of our time advising partnerships on how to devote time appropriately and productively and really helping them form an identity as a partnership that extends beyond whatever their individual institutional interests are, but in a way where they understand that there's going to be collective benefit in some way, shape, or form. But why bother with partnerships if they are so challenging and take so much time? I think in the end that they can produce, and they can produce in ways that singular institutions cannot. So the reality is, any challenge that needs to be addressed in a particular city or in a particular locality or even across borders cannot be successfully addressed without the combined resources and know-how across sector. And so the key to me is to find the vehicles through which these different entities can come together and begin to join their brains and their expertise and their resources in a matter that creates a new contribution to whatever the issue is. If they're trying to solve a social issue, or if they're trying to look at common interests in a geographical setting, the benefits are very significant long term.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is David Morass. He's founder and CEO of Marga, Inc. David, you've worked so much with universities. I want you to tell me how you think what you've learned about university-community partnerships can be applied to a broader set of anchor institutions. You've foreshadowed that by your earlier comment, but just thinking about the array of institutions that exist in almost every community, the libraries, the parks, the community colleges, the hospitals, an array of institutions that could, performing arts centers would be another good one, an array of institutions that have resources, that often have physical facilities, that have staff, that have purchasing power, that have networking capability. Can you take the same notion that of universities have a lot to gain by being invested in community partnerships? Can you take that same idea and apply it across a wider range of institutions?
Mm-hmm. And I'll just back up a little bit historically in answering that question. Universities surfaced in my work when I was at the Rockefeller Foundation, and I was handling a portfolio called Building Community, which was looking at comprehensive community development initiatives. And so my first frame of reference in thinking about community partnerships is actually communities or cities, regions, neighborhoods, first starting there and then trying to figure out where are resources, assets locally that can be leveraged to improve those particular settings. And one of the reasons universities surfaced in the first place as a major point of focus in my own work is because in so many cities, universities appeared to be underutilized, untapped resources, and they had such significant geographical interests And so many resources across the board in terms of a combination of economic resources as well as knowledge resources as well as person power. Now, that being said, some of the principles that have emerged in terms of university-community partnerships are transferable to other sectors. The reality is that all major institutions make major economic contributions, and those contributions can be tapped in some way, shape, or form to improve cities. What we're trying to figure out with museums and with hospitals and with libraries and with other types of major institutions is what are the unique contributions that those institutions can bring. And I think part of what's universal is the fact that there are so many resources in cities that are not being fully tapped. And we have to figure out strategies to actually address that. It wouldn't look the same for every industry, for every type of institution. Obviously, there are some things that cut across. So as you look at economics in terms of employment and purchasing, whether you're looking at a university or a corporation or a hospital or a museum, that cuts across the board. But then there are questions of the uniqueness in terms of the resources that they provide. Obviously, with hospitals, we're talking about healthcare. With museums, we're talking about attractions as far as arts are concerned in terms of tourism and the interest that they can bring and so many other various opportunities in that respect. But the reality for all of these institutions across sector is that they have to figure out how to work together and they have to figure out how to work beyond their boundaries. And that really is the core of our work at MARGA, is to help facilitate these kinds of cross-sector partnerships that enable people to come to some common agenda that transcends institutional interests.
Let's think for a minute about museums, David. You mentioned museums, so let's stick there a moment. There are some obvious things that museums contribute to the success of a city. As you said, they become attractions. They become perhaps tourism draws. They educate. They make a population literate. So certainly those are things that you and I could sit here and make a list on today, and we wouldn't need to explore that any further. It's pretty obvious. Do you think there are things, if you dig down deeper, are there things that you can discover in terms of a unique contribution an institution could make that maybe we see small signs of, sort of bits of success here and there, but generally museums, as a for instance, as an example, museums would not be generally engaged in those kinds of activities or contributing to the overall success of a city in that way?
I think what we should do as far as museums and other institutions are concerned is to try to create the forums in which there can be creative thinking about new ways for these institutions to in some way tap into their resource base in a way that helps advance their own agenda, but also simultaneously contributes to the city. So for a museum, the case might be, how do you become more known? How do you gain more traffic? And that is always going to be an interest of a museum. So in what way does that converge with interests in other parts of the city? And so how do different institutions come together in some form of a network or a forum where they can begin to discuss these ideas and strategically come up with new possibilities? I think a lot of major institutions, and I've been talking to my students about this, really face a couple of different strands of thinking about how they engage in their cities. One strand is very much focused on what they bring to the table no matter what, as you mentioned, the things that are obvious. Obviously, a museum is an attraction, and it brings attention, and it brings traffic and tourism. But there is a next level, and that is the level, to me, of engagement and participation. So what extra steps would a museum have to take to sit down at the table with hospitals, with universities, with the local government, with local businesses, to think strategically about new ways that the museum can contribute to the city through partnerships? So I think the concept of partnership in itself and of direct engagement is critical. We have to create the vehicles through which partnerships can form, and different institutions across sector can actually arrive at different concepts and different strategies that can be beneficial all around.
If a community's institutions were perfectly networked, what would that look like, David, and what do you think would be the result?
I do wonder about the role that mayors in cities can play as conveners, and I do often wonder about the disconnect in terms of resources and networking in cities, and whether or not there are strategies to somehow foster collaboration across the board. So I would think that you would, in some way, shape, or form, require some activity from mayor's offices to convene in some way, shape, or form local institutions and have local institutions begin to collectively contribute to a citywide vision. And the citywide vision then provides the opportunity through which the institutions can carve out a role that makes sense for them and the city within. And so there's a strategic planning concept that I think is not happening in many major cities that really needs to happen, because the reality is that on the government side, this is very much in the government's interest, the resources aren't there like they may have been in previous times. And the reality is these kinds of partnerships are not only important to do, they're actually necessary for the future of cities.
David, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Okay, thank you.
David Morass is CEO of Marga. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Stopping occasionally to reflect on what we've become is not only necessary for organizations. CityView's commentator Walker Smith says it's also good for us as individuals.
My youngest sister was born when I was a sophomore in high school. When I graduated from college, she had just finished first grade. My graduation day was a very hot Mother's Day. The president of the university acknowledged the heat in his speech to our graduating class, and consequently, he kept his remarks short. I met my family afterwards, and we were walking back to the main quad to take pictures when my sister suddenly blurted out that she was sure glad that man didn't speak very long, because that whole thing just went on too long. We chuckled, as did a man walking behind us who caught up a step to lean down to my sister and say, "Honey, you're right about that thing going on too long." We turned around and saw that the man laughing with my sister was the president himself. We immediately offered flustered apologies that he just laughed off. So we shook hands and said goodbye in good spirits. "Out of the mouths of babes," we murmured to ourselves as the president walked away. A friend of mine was playing a word game with his children one afternoon. The game was to go through the alphabet one letter at a time and think of a word beginning with that letter that described God. When they got to the letter D, his 5-year-old daughter hesitated for a moment, then triumphantly declared, "D, damn good." My friend spent the rest of playtime trying to get his daughter to understand that that was not an appropriate answer. But she pleaded in rebuttal, "Gosh, Daddy, it starts with a D and ends in good." My friend told me the story and then said under his breath, "Out of the mouths of babes." Children keep us honest with their naive frankness. My sister made us laugh by saying out loud what we were all thinking. She just stated the obvious. My friend's daughter did the same. Faced with the honesty of children, we look at ourselves differently. Sometimes, though, the self-reflection we see in the mirror of our children is not very flattering. We've all seen the dark pictures drawn by children who've grown up amid abuse, war, or terrorism. As parents, we know that children often express turmoil at home through misbehavior, depression, nightmares, or even drug abuse. Dr. Georgia Witkin, director of the stress program at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine, says that children are under more stress nowadays because their parents are more stressed. Children feel overbooked, she says, because their parents are overbooked. And children no longer see their parents relax or de-stress. Hence, quite often, what we see through our children is not an unvarnished view of the world, but the unvarnished truth about ourselves. Today, children spend about 30 minutes less in free play each day than they did in 1981. One of the chief reasons is that parents find their schedules more frantic and time-pressured, so they turn to organized activities as a means of providing care and supervision for their children. Which means that children have fewer opportunities just to hang out with friends or their own imaginations. Like many baby boomers, I grew up with lots of free time to kill, climbing trees, riding bikes, splashing through creeks, and playing kick the can with the neighborhood gang late into a summer's day until our mothers called us home in the gathering dusk. Free play was a sort of youthful accomplishment back then. But that sort of balance is not something that our children are likely to learn on their own these days, because balance is not something they encounter much anymore. Art Linkletter is remembered for his 27-year run on national TV, showing us how kids say the darndest things. Like one day when he asked a little boy if there was anything that his mother had asked him not to say on the show, to which the boy replied, "She told me not to let any skeletons out of the closet." But that, of course, is what is always revealed by the reflection of ourselves in our children. And to polish that image, we must start by polishing up ourselves. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders whose next national meeting is May 1st and 2nd in San Jose to discuss turning urban amenities into urban assets. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.